All right, we're back.
We're back.
Crime and Time on the Rocks.
Yay, but we're up.
We're up, yeah. So we're having a lavender lemon drop.
Okay, so I saw this drink on Facebook. A friend of mine was at a fancy restaurant and she ordered one and I'm like, we must.
Yeah, so I didn't find actual lavender, fresh lavender, because I guess it's like not available right now.
Yeah.
And I didn't know where I could purchase some. And I live in a small town that doesn't have options for buying stuff like that. So, and we did have an herb store, but it went out of sale, or it went out of business.
An herb store?
Yeah.
That is crazy.
So there went that. So I experimented yesterday to try to find a recipe. Basically, it's just your classic lemon drop. And then the first iteration I tried, I used some lavender essential oil, and it was disgusting.
But you put in 2 drops.
I put in 2 drops, which apparently is like 25 drops too many.
Yes.
It was.
You used 2 drops for like a gallon of lemonade.
I had to throw the whole thing out. It was so disgusting. So this one is with some lavender bitters.
And can you taste the lavender? Well, I guess we'll find out.
Well, we'll find out. I mean, I couldn't quite remember how much I added yesterday. Uh-huh. And then just after I made these drinks just now, I threw in a couple more drops on each of our drinks. So it could be gross. I don't know.
Okay. We'll find out. We ready?
Try it. Yep.
It's got a lot of pulp in it. Yuck.
I can taste it a little bit.
Yes. I like it. I like lavender though.
Yeah, I do like lavender, but after yesterday, it was too disgusting.
Mm-mm-mm.
But no, this is good. It's not overwhelming for Mm-mm. me.
I'm going to put in some dirty ice.
I can smell it.
With a really good shaker here.
So yeah, absence fresh lavender, I think the bitters are definitely the way to go.
Yeah.
And I already had them, so that was nice. Because again, it's, you know, COVID shopping time and it's hard to find things.
COVID shopping. All right. Do you want to talk first or you want me to talk first?
I can go. My okay. iPod's sitting right here. So I don't know if you've heard this story. I had heard it previously, but there was some new news added to it that I Ooh. Hadn't heard until I started researching it. This is the story of lavender dough.
Lavender dough. I've not even heard of lavender dough.
Yeah. So about 14 years ago, lavender dough was found dead. They named her Lavender Doe after the purple shirt she was wearing because she Aww. Wasn't identified. And her case was prominently featured on the Doe Project and on Web Sleuths. Like a lot of amateur investigators go onto these sites to try to see if they can add anything or help solve various stories. And this is one of the ones that was there early on and that was pretty popular for the people that go on these sites. One of the reasons why her story was so popular is because she has perfect teeth.
Oh my.
Yeah. So, okay. So Lavender, like I said, Lavender Doe had perfect teeth. That's why so many of the strangers online began to notice her case.
Interesting.
Yeah. She was found.
So there wouldn't really be dental records because unless she had them made perfect.
Right. So her body was found really badly burned, which is part of the reason why they couldn't identify her. She was found on October 29th, 2006, near Longview, Texas. The two men who found her had been out doing some target practicing, and they mm-hmm. came upon her, and at first they thought it was a mannequin, like, don't we all?
Right.
And
when we find bodies on the side of the road.
Yeah. And they both had kind of thought, like, was this like a Halloween thing? Because it was October 29th.
Uh-huh.
And then as they got closer, they realized that there was an odor that was definitely not a mannequin burning.
Yeah.
She was still on fire.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it had just happened, or, you know, recently happened.
Recently, yeah.
When the police came, they started looking at any of the facts that they could help identify her. Noticed that she was probably between 17 and 25 years old. She had blonde hair with strawberry highlights. There was $40 in her pocket. And like I said before, she had a pale purple shirt. And her jeans were size 7 to 8. And they were a brand called One Tough Babe, which is not a brand I've worn before.
No, me either.
And this was like I said, in 2006. So I'm trying to recall back in 2006 what kind of jeans I had worn, but it definitely wasn't one
tough. There were a lot of Western jeans around that time that were mimicking Miss Me. I've heard of Tough Girl.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. And Cowgirl Tough, but not One Tough Babe. But it doesn't, it sounds like something that there would be, you know,
yeah, it does.
In that genre.
It does sound like that. So days
genre of jeans.
Jean genre. Genre. So days passed, then weeks, then years, and nobody ever was able to identify her. No friends or family ever called the sheriff's office. No one filed a missing persons report.
Oh my.
And the name Lavender Doe, which was the name given to her by one of the internet sleuths, was the only name she had been known as for more than a dozen years.
Oh, wow.
So in November of 2018, a group of amateur investigators believed that they had uncovered her real name. And this was just a few months after volunteer genealogists with the DNA Doe Project had helped Ohio law enforcement identify a murder victim who was previously called Buckskin Girl, which Ooh. I kind of want to look up.
Yeah.
So.
Now, just thinking about the jeans again. In that around that time, I was shopping for my jeans at a very small feed store in a small little town. And near a lavender farm. And she was very meticulous because she said, we're one of the only places to buy jeans. And I want to get a variety because I don't want all the girls in town's butts to look the same.
Which is totally true, because they would have.
They would have.
It's such a small town, there wasn't anywhere to shop.
Exactly. And so thinking about that, if it had been somewhere like that, they could have gone to the records. Because she kept records, like meticulous records. They wrote down what you bought when you bought it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think anyone would have thought that.
Exactly.
But being an amateur sleuth, you would have thought that.
I would have thought that. Let's check her jeans.
Well, speaking of amateur sleuths, cold cases have always attracted people that are interested in helping to solve mysteries or murders or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar to...
I really like this drink.
I do like it. after my PTSD yesterday with like the disgusting... I had to throw the drink out, and I never throw drinks
you
out.
You do not. We will drink something so gross and you will drink it anyway.
I can only think of a couple other times I've gotten rid of a drink because it was too bad.
That's crazy.
So the people that were involved in this case were genetic genealogists.
Ooh.
So it's basically like similar to the technique they used to solve the Golden State Killer.
Yeah,
and people can do it from like their homes because you're just retracing genealogy.
I watched a program on a woman who does this.
Oh yeah. And so there's a pretty big group of them. The biggest one is the DNA Doe Project. And so three in particular of these amateur genealogists that were working on the Lavender Doe case were Kevin Lord. He was a 35-year-old. He was studying to be a private investigator. Missy Koski, she's 55. She was 55 at the time. And she was a quote-unquote search angel. She helped adoptees find their birth parents.
Aww.
And she was an adoptee, and that's how she got into it, by locating her own birth parents. Uh-huh. And then Lori Gaff, a 49-year-old genealogy enthusiast, she had an encyclopedic memory, and she basically remembered, like, every true crime show on TV and, like, remembered all the techniques and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And this is funny. She says, I've seen almost all of them now, so I've moved on to the Food Network.
Yeah.
So these three have been exchanging Facebook messages and like just working together on identifying the Lavender Doe, making an identification in her case. And then they finally decided to meet up. So they were able to, over 6 weeks, they traced the origins of Lavender Doe back to more than a century, all the way to Europe. And they also traced her life, her present life. They went through public records. They went through MySpace profiles because that was a thing then. And then they finally decided to go to Longview, Texas, and like go to the scene itself and try to retrace her steps.
Uh-huh. So they found her family, her ancestors, but they were still looking for her.
Yes.
That is so stinking cool.
Yes. It's interesting. Like, I get to it a little bit later on how they do it, but... So Kevin Lord was the first one to be, well, he wasn't the first one ever, but he was one of the first to become obsessed with the Lavender Doe case. So he lived in Texas and lived near the area. And he had been looking into these other disappearances of two women that disappeared separately near where he lived in Texas. Uh-huh. So he was trying to match their cases to any unclaimed bodies. And of course he came upon Lavender Doe. And then he started looking into her story and found web sleuths and found, like, that's how she got her name because of the lavender shirt, and someone on Web Sleuths had called her Lavender Doe. And then there were just, like, he read through all these pages and pages and pages of speculation about why her teeth were so perfect, like, what her clothes meant, the circumstances of her death.
And had they determined yet that she was from the United States? Because they said her ancestors were from Europe.
At this point, no. But, like, they get it figured out later. So, it was also a prominent story on Reddit, in, like, those subreddits. And this woman, in particular, they don't name her, but she annually would make a post about the girl with the perfect smile. And then she would basically start naming all the missing persons that didn't fit her case that, like, people had brought up. So, she would, like, search for potential missing persons that could have matched and then rule them out.
Right.
But
very smart.
Basically, she didn't really do much more than just her annual post. She was just trying to keep the case alive.
Yeah.
But the perfect teeth are what made Kevin interested, and
it's so interesting that that's what people flock to.
I know, because I've seen, like, her pictures, and I wouldn't have initially been like, oh my God, her teeth, you know? Right. Like, I just was like, oh, that's a girl.
Yeah. But I guess if she, well, depending on where the burn was, whether the teeth, this is gruesome, but the teeth would be exposed.
Mm-hmm. Apparently my watch told me to stand up, and I didn't.
Stand up.
I didn't.
Is it angry with you now?
And then it told me, congratulations for standing up.
Your hand stood up, and you just didn't.
I know.
I have not worn, I need to get a watch.
So,
I just have my old Fitbit.
Kevin, like I said, was also one of the people that looked into the teeth. And so she had a complete lack of cavities and fillings, but she also had two baby teeth, which were unusual for someone her age, which I also had up until I got my implants. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. I think my dad to this day still has the same two baby teeth that I had removed and had implants.
How very cool.
Yeah.
I thought child number one still had baby teeth because I do not remember her losing molars. But we were just at the dentist and they said she does not have baby teeth. So it is time for the braces.
Oh, gosh.
Although she doesn't have to have them. She's going to get Invisalign.
And oh, that's nice.
Yeah, he thinks that she can do it in just a couple trays.
Yeah, that'll be nice because then she can actually take them off to brush her teeth and not be gross.
Not be gross. Yeah. Braces are so disgusting.
Yes, they are. I went through that.
Yes, I think most people did.
So Kevin, back to Kevin. He found this girl that was missing from Texas who also had some distinctive teeth. And he thought, well, maybe maybe they're the same girl.
Uh-huh.
So he went on Reddit and posted the theory. He also talked to the Gregg County Sheriff's Office and to the lieutenant in charge. And that lieutenant was Eddie Hope. And they talked to Hope in this story, and he said that he was used to people sending him tips and everything because it was, like, a prominent case online.
Yeah.
And they had already ruled out the missing girl that Kevin had found. But, Lieutenant Hope was, like, obviously just happy that people were still interested in the case.
So they're ruling out these missing girls as not her. But they're not necessarily finding them. They're just saying, this girl is a different girl.
Yeah.
Move on. We'll figure it out.
It couldn't have
later.
Been her because of X, Y, or Z.
Gotcha.
But
their girl is still missing. They've not discovered her. She's just not this girl.
Yes. Like, perhaps for various reasons, they were able to rule these other girls out. But Kevin's still on the case. So he, during his free time, he filed a whole bunch of Public Records Act requests. He collected court documents. He, via social media, would interview friends and family of all these missing girls and, like, try to say, could this be her? Could this be her?
Mm-hmm.
And, just kept working at it. So the DNA Doe Project, as I mentioned before, it was founded in 2017. And what their aim was to persuade law enforcement officials to do further DNA tests on these unidentified bodies, because even when they did a DNA test, law enforcement technology would only test for 13 to 20 markers, just mm-hmm. enough to make an identification.
Yeah. Well, and if there's nothing to compare it to.
Yeah. But so the technology used, like in the Golden State Killer case and like in this case eventually, was more like how 23andMe or Ancestry DNA tests, and they test for 300 or they test for more than 600,000 markers.
Wow.
So between 13 and 20 for the normal law enforcement to 600,000, which is enables them to do all this extra genealogy.
Right. That's how they matches. Can trace the ancestors and whatnot back.
Yes.
Very cool.
So I thought that was kind of interesting.
I need to do the 23andMe.
Yeah, I did the Ancestry one, which I guess is like they're very similar.
Yeah.
It was interesting. So yeah, they explain that it goes even further. Like, I mean, it'll reveal third cousins, fourth cousins, even more wow. distant cousins. And then, so that's where these amateur genealogists come in, is they basically put the pieces together.
Uh-huh.
So like if, you know, Jane Smith popped up as a relation to you, they could figure out why, and then they start putting the family trees together. Like who are Jane's parents? Right. Does Jane have children? Whatever, whatever.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And you can see, like, I mean, a professional, like, police investigator might not have the time to do all of that.
Oh, I'm sure that's incredibly time-consuming.
Mm-hmm.
But it all leads down to two. I mean, it all leads back to two people. And then that branch and that branch and that branch and that branch.
Yeah.
Although there's sub-branches, because those two people marry other people.
Mm-hmm.
And bring in other things.
Yeah, it can get really vast.
I would like to get into that, I think. Not that I have any spare time, but I
maybe
enjoy
when
it.
You do have spare time.
When will that be?
Like after you
When will that be?
After you finish reading that one book you started 12 years ago.
Hey, so we're going out of town this weekend and I'm going to take my book. I might get, you know, 10 or 20 pages down.
So, now Missy. So Missy Koski, like I said before, was an adoptee, and so she had used all these techniques to find her birth father. And after that, she became obsessed with it, and she was spending like 12 to 16 hours a day helping.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, she was helping adoptees find their birth parents. I'm assuming she was getting a fee.
I would hope so, because you have no time for a job.
Yeah. And then she began working as a volunteer genealogist for the DNA Doe Project in 2018. So later in 2018, the DNA Doe Project was able to crowdfund $1,400 to have Lavender Doe's DNA reanalyzed to get to those 600,000 markers.
Nice. But isn't 23andMe $100?
Well, they couldn't. I don't think they could go through the commercial.
Yeah. Well, because they don't have spit, which is what they use.
Yes. And they had to get the official DNA from, like, the actual crime lab or whatever.
I want another drink. That was real. I mean, I don't, but it was really good.
So,
sitting here listening to a story and I have nothing to drink.
I know. Well, this is like probably like the longest story I've told in a long time. You're just not used to it.
I'm the one who tells the long stories.
I know. So also around the same time, like late in 2018, the Gray County Sheriff's Office had an unrelated breakthrough. So when Lavender Doe was found, they found semen inside of her.
Oh.
And it had matched to a man named Joseph Wayne Burnett. And
I guess that's not sad. It doesn't necessarily have to be violence. But typically, you don't set your partner on fire when you're done having sex.
Yeah. Well, that's what he said. He said that, yeah, he had sex with her, but it was consensual. And so then later in the summer of 2018, a woman living with Burnett disappeared. So this is like, you know, this is when they start looking at him again.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Hope and, you know, the other sheriff's deputies found her body. They questioned Burnett, and he just basically laid it all out there. He's like, yeah, I killed her, and I killed Lavender Doe.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And he said that he didn't know Lavender. He wasn't able to identify her. He just picked her up, and she was a stranger.
And that just had sex with him, and he set on fire.
Yes.
Why would you do that to a stranger? That seems so violent.
Well, I mean, he did it to people he knows too, so he obviously wasn't that discriminating about how he treated people.
That's true. I would just, that just seems very violent for a perfect stranger.
So anyway, they filed murder indictments on him, and
that's
her
crazy
name, yeah, her name was still listed as Lavender Doe because they still had not
he
identified
doesn't know
her.
Who she is
he didn't know. Yeah,
just some random chick that he just had sex with and then set on fire.
Yeah.
What was her actual cause of death?
I don't know if I have that here.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't remember her saying that.
Yeah, I don't know if I can't remember if I have that. Maybe if I do later,
yeah,
I'll remember. But so the DNA Doe Project got Lavender Doe's DNA back. And so then they uploaded it into this genealogy database called GED Match. And this is the same database they used to find the Golden State Killer. Uh-huh. So they had all these matches, like thousands of matches, but most of them were really, really distant. And then...
And you need a close one to find a close relative, obviously.
Yeah, the closer the better. So the closest matches that she had were a second cousin once removed and then some third and fourth cousins.
Oh my gosh.
So that's
And that
why...
is that because they can only use the people who have submitted their DNA to the websites that share with this database?
Yes.
And not all websites share with the database, and right. not all people do it.
So even if you...
Like, I haven't done it.
Even if you do a 23andMe or Ancestry.com, your DNA is not shared with any other database because these companies don't share it. But you can go and take your results and plug them into these other databases. Some of them share and some of them don't.
So people may not even know that they are able to do that to help with this stuff.
Yeah. And so like those other databases will also give you like other things, like maybe there's like food sensitivity or, you know, like other traits that aren't, they don't really look at on 23andMe, or uh-huh. it's just a bigger pool to try to see if you wanted to put your family tree together. So people do that.
I want to do that just to, not that I think that any of my relatives are murderers, but I want to help.
Yeah.
If I can.
Well, so.
That's kind of cool.
This particular database doesn't really share the way they did with the Lavender Doe case or the Golden State Killer case. I think because it was just getting too overwhelmed. But anyway.
I guess that would make sense because there's so many unsolved mysteries.
Yes. But in 2018 they did. So then all the volunteers start working, and eventually they found a woman in her late 50s who was living in Texas, just 30 miles away from where Lavender was found dead, who was a closer relative. So Kevin drove out to contact her, and the woman was kind of hesitant, but then he talked to her and like shared the idea of the DNA Doe Project, and then she eventually agreed to help. Uh-huh. So they found out that Lavender Doe was probably the child of that woman's cousin. And so the woman didn't even realize she had a cousin like that would have matched this description. So.
Well, yeah, I have cousins that I have no idea that are there.
Yeah. So the DNA Doe Project kept searching. And they finally found that one of her uncles had a daughter who was from a previous marriage. And so that was the cousin.
Oh, wow.
So that daughter was named Robin. Kevin found a death certificate for her and found out that Robin had died from an illness just a month before Lavender Doe was found dead.
Oh.
So now they like at least they had her. She was a close match, so they kept researching. And
I would think if they had Robin, they should be able to find Lavender Doe's identity.
Yeah, and that's what they're looking for right now. But
there's no birth certificate. Like, you can find birth certificates that are attributed to me. Two yeah. different counties, but you can find them.
One of the problems is she had like a billion last names.
Yeah. And also they're filed within counties, so you mm-hmm. would have a hard time. Like, both of my children were born in different counties. Mm-hmm. Not because we moved, but because child number two was born on the side of the road.
That's true.
But not quite the county line.
No. But anyway, so they, like I said, she had a whole bunch of last names. They finally found a man by the name of Johnny Dodd, and they found out that he had a daughter who was about Lavender's age.
Uh-huh.
So.
Who was associated with this woman,
Robin.
The cousin of something.
Yes.
Somehow. Okay.
So now they have the name Dana Lynn Dodd, and they start looking into her. They found out that that was probably Lavender Doe. She was 21 years old when she was...
Did she have perfect teeth?
Well, basically. Yeah. No, I have that down here.
Sorry. Keep interrupting.
So, they identified Dana Lynn Dodd as Lavender Doe. And so, when Dana Dodd was finally identified, Missy said, "You want to have a party and jump up and down. Oh, wait, we can't have that kind of attitude."
Yeah, someone is still dead.
Yeah. So Missy is the one that really looked into Dana's family.
Oh.
So she found out that Dana Dodd was not the daughter of a dentist, that her perfect teeth were just luck.
Wow.
Her mother died, like I said, fairly young, like in her 50s. According to the police records, her father was homeless and he'd been arrested numerous times for public intoxication and disorderly conduct. Dana's parents never really raised her. So she went from household to household. She lived with her stepmom in Arizona for some time. That was like around when she was 14. And then her stepmom sent her to live with some other family in Florida. And that family, it was like they were related to her, but doesn't say how. But they got her into counseling. But Dana was just by that time rebelling against everything. So then she went to live with an older half brother, and she didn't stay there very long. She had been in trouble with the police for underage smoking and for fighting, which, you know, it's not the worst thing ever, but she had a boyfriend who was no good. She smoked weed. She used pills. She dropped out of high school. And
sadness.
Yeah.
So just having raised toddlers who don't want to brush their teeth, that is amazing that she had perfect teeth. Mm-hmm. Like, amazing.
So
that's a very silly thing to focus on.
Well, but it's interesting that so many people focused on it, though.
Yeah.
Because like I said, I saw her picture and it didn't strike me like as something I would have focused on.
Yeah.
But, so Dana, in high school, after dropping out of high school, she went to live with her best friend. And shortly thereafter, she skipped town. She joined one of those traveling magazine sales crews, which are basically like human smugglers.
I've had those kids come to the door, though.
Yes, I have too.
Or the soap salesman.
I haven't had the...
Well, it's like cleaner.
Oh.
It's good cleaner, but it's still, you know, the kid with the little laminated pamphlet.
Doing the human trafficking.
Ugh.
So
how does that work? How is that human trafficking? So they, like, kidnap you when they come to the door?
No. The kids involved are basically being human trafficked.
The ones that are selling the soap. How is that lucrative, selling soap and magazines door to door?
I have no idea.
Because my entire life, I've bought one thing of soap from those kids that come to the door. And they probably come once or twice a year.
I will say, just working where I work, even with people that are in college to be educated, people aren't very savvy.
Are stupid. Yeah.
Yeah.
People are stupid.
Like, they fall for those, like, send me $2,000 in iTunes cards and I'll send you, like, you know, $6,000 back kind of deals all the time.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I had a thing on eBay once that I had. It's a very nice paperweight. It was my aunt's. And it's ugly as F, but it's worth a lot of money. So I tried to sell it on eBay, and this guy was like, I want to buy this for my sister, blah, blah, blah. It's perfect. I want to get her something else, too. I'm in the military overseas. Here's what I want you to do. Put it in a box, buy a gift card for this obscure random store that we don't even have in this area. Put that in the box, too, and I'll pay you for both the paperweight and the gift card.
How about no?
Yeah, that's what I said. I'm like, no.
So anyway.
We got sidetracked.
Burnett, the killer,
mm-hmm.
He told police that Dana had tried to sell him magazines, and then he said no to that. Then she tried to sell him lingerie, which I don't know where she got that from. But then he basically
said... Never had one try to sell me lingerie.
He basically said no and no, and then she asked to get into his car. So that's how they hooked up.
Oh, interesting. I actually accidentally invited... Well, I've done it a couple times, but I accidentally invited one in one time because he's like, this can take off hard water stains. I'm like, no, it can't. So he had to come show me, and it did. That's the one I bought because it actually took off the
water. Please come into my home.
Another one, though, I was drinking a beer and a vacuum cleaner salesman kid came to the door and he's like, it's the end of my shift. I'd really like one of those. And we ended up like drinking beer and taking shots together.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's amazing that I'm alive.
So anyway, the best friend that she had lived with temporarily was named Bobby Lynn Hodges. They met in 10th grade, and they both had troubled backgrounds. Bobby and Dana lived in a duplex in Jacksonville, Florida, when they lived together. And then right after her 18th birthday, Bobby found out she was pregnant, and that's when her and Dana started having difficulties. Because Bobby was like,
I gotta grow up.
Yeah, I'm gonna have this baby. I need to get clean. And Dana was not ready to stop partying. And then she started doing heroin after that.
Ew, that's bad road.
Yeah, then she stole a PlayStation from Bobby's apartment. This is all according to Bobby. And then
yeah.
Bobby kicked her out. And that's when Dana joined the magazine crew. So
that's insane. What yeah. a weird life.
I know. Like, it's not a life I've ever experienced, but it sounds awful.
And have perfect teeth.
And you still have perfect teeth.
Because, you know, it's important, even when you're passed out on heroin, to brush and floss.
Some of Dana's family did, in the intervening years, try to look her up. So they would, like, search on MySpace for her, and then when Facebook came out, they would send messages to all these different Dana Dodds, but none of them were her, because she'd been dead before MySpace, or before yeah. Facebook came out. And then, so finally, on December...
That's interesting that she had relatives looking for her, though.
Yes.
And like, yet it took so long to find her.
I know. They thought, well, because she had been bouncing around all over the place, and then when she left with that magazine crew, they thought, you know, that's... She left again, you know?
Yeah.
And then, like, the one main relative that they interviewed, I feel like it was, like, her half-sister, I think. And so they never really, like, lived together ever, so they just naturally lost touch.
Uh-huh.
But she wondered, like, you know, what's Dana doing? And, like, started, you know, looking her up and wasn't able to find much. But in news you can use, this is recent. So December 15th of 2020, which was only, like, 15 days ago from the day we're recording this.
Wow.
Joseph Wayne Burnett pled guilty to killing Dana Lynn Dodd and the other missing woman whose name was Felicia Pearson. He's been in the Gray County Jail since 2018, and he was sentenced to serve 50 years on each murder charge. He took a plea deal just to, like, make things easier. So this is... I used the DNA Doe Project, the News Journal, which was somewhere out of Longview, Texas, but I can't really read it here. Anyway, the News Journal from Texas and the Atlantic magazine.
That's fascinating.
So I'd heard this story before. I want to say there was, like, a episode of one of the shows, like your Dateline or like 2020s or something, and she had not been identified yet. So back when we were thinking about doing a different episode that involved, I think, The Color Purple, I found this story and I was like, oh, I need to do this. And I hadn't even, like, really researched it. I just had remembered. So when I actually started doing this particular story, I was like, oh, I'm going to do the Lavender Doe. That makes total sense. And then I'm, like, reading and I'm like, They know who she is. She has a name.
That's really neat. So you found out about it before they discovered who she was. You got more. Well, obviously you got more information because it just happened 15 days ago.
Well,
and
yeah,
picked this drink forever ago.
Yes. Well, and then when we first picked the drink, it was, like, probably around the first one that we ended up not doing, or, like, I did something different, I don't remember. But that was, like, right around when they identified her. So it could have been either before or during when they identified her, because it was a couple years ago.
Oh, that's super cool.
So, yeah, that's Lavender Doe.
Lavender Doe. I'm out of drink and I'm very upset about it.
More to come.
So my story, this was the last one that I wrote, and I was just very like, what am I going to do? Because we've done so many lemon things and there's just not a lot of lemon stuff in history. So you sent me an email or a text and you were like, what about this? And it was the Lavender Wars. And you're like, didn't even research it. Just put in Lavender War and this popped up.
Yeah. I Googled Lavender Wars because I was like trying to help you out. And then this thing popped up, and I was like, don't read it. I'll just send it to her.
Yeah. So I read it, and it's awesome. It's pretty short, but it's very cool. So my first source, I use the Betty Friedan biography. I use Lesbians Battled for Their Place in 1960s Feminism. The Lavender Menace had some second waivers. Ass over tit. Okay. I did not write it down, but the people that are involved in the story are apparently from the South, and it really cracked me up because they used a lot of colloquialisms and sayings from the South, and ass over tit was one, and the other was they were running around, they didn't know whether to something shit or go blind. I have literally heard my grandmother say that. Like, I have heard her say that she didn't know whether to shit or go blind. Like, yes, that rings true. Rita Mae Brown, Lavender Menace, Day 4 of Pride, 30 Project for Pride Month 2018. LGBT Project Wiki. They have their own Wikipedia, which was identical to Wikipedia. The Lavender Menace, Steve Siller, I, Steve, and Betty Friedman versus The Lavender Menace. So those are my sources. Here's my story.
The Lavender Menace.
The Lavender Menace. So to start the story, I have to go backward a little while. In 1963, there was a writer and a feminist and women's rights activist named Betty Friedman.
Friedan.
Oh, Friedan. I'm reading it wrong because I've had... what is this?
Lavender lemon drop.
I've had a lavender lemon drop. And she and also I can't see because I'm blind and old. She published a book called The Feminine Mystique. And that was, she was basically, I guess, a bored housewife or something. I don't know.
Yeah, we had to read it for a college class I took.
Seriously? Mm-hmm. Ooh, I don't think that I would enjoy it. But she wanted to find fulfillment beyond the traditional roles, which I have found, especially being home for Christmas break. I revel in the traditional roles. Like, I woke up this morning and I cleaned the kitchen and I made biscuits and I was just happy.
I feel like, though, back then, like, if you look at, like, Mad Men or whatever, when it was, like, that's all that was expected of you, of course you wanted to think, like, but I want to do this thing or that thing. And now, like, we can do whatever we want to do.
And not only that, but we're expected to do other things. Like, I am expected to have a job and a career. And I would prefer to be home making biscuits.
Yeah.
Yeah, you always want what you can't have. But anyway, so she's so she co-founds, after this book success, she co-founds the National Organization for Women in 1966.
Okay.
She served as its first president and was very proud of NOW. She worked really hard to get it taken seriously and wanting, you know, she wanted this group to be an actual political contender and... She was very extremely concerned. I'm going to say some things that are not very nice in the telling of this story. Just know these are not my opinions. These are expressions of the 1960s and this story. Not my opinions, not my opinions.
Got it. Not your opinions.
So she is very concerned about the... man-hating butch lesbians coming into her group and destroying it, being the National Organization for Women. However, even the man-hating butch lesbians are women.
So did she think because they wouldn't have traditional, like, women's roles because they weren't married to men and didn't raise... children with men, that they would automatically want to be part of her group?
Yes.
Okay.
She thought that, well, I will actually say a line that she said later that explains that. But her fear was that her group would then just be dismissed as, oh, that's a bunch of man-hating lesbians. We don't need to listen to them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So her group takes off. It's huge. NOW is arguably one of the most important feminist organizations at the time. But there's tensions. She's still very concerned about these mannish or man-hating lesbians, and she thinks that they are going to hinder her cause. The notion of the lesbian aesthetic or agenda would compromise feminist political power or mar their image in the broader culture.
Yes.
So other groups are dealing with this because, according to Betty, the lesbians want to get into any group with women in the title. But few of them, even though they're struggling with this and concerned about this all over with other women's organizations, they're not excluding them. Friedan did.
Oh, okay.
She's like, no, thank you. You go join something else.
Go join another women's group. You're not welcome here.
Right? Isn't that insane?
You're not the kind of woman we had in mind.
You're not the kind of woman we want. So she resisted having lesbians in. She didn't want any affiliation with lesbian organizations. A person named Del Martin, who was a longtime activist and founder of the Daughters of Bilitis, which I don't know what that is. It was the first official lesbian organization in the country. She said that, quote, Betty Friedan was such a homophobe. She was so afraid of the stigma that lesbians might bring to the organization. As soon as I was on the board of NOW, this woman got in. She was on the phone to the New York Times saying that lesbians are ruining her movement and that some of them had tried to seduce her.
She wishes.
Right? So she was very anti-lesbian. We don't want you around here. She organizes the first Congress to unite women in that same year. And they...
Some women.
Only a few, not you or you. You're pretty femme. You can come in. But don't seduce me.
You only want to do traditional, like, women's gender roles, so you can't be included. But also, you're not doing traditional women's gender roles.
Right. So or you are doing traditional
You're not
women's
doing women's
roles.
Stuff right.
You're literally doing women, but you're not doing women's stuff right. Oh. So she's got this Congress going, and she is... She's very concerned that, you know, they're going to destroy everything. So Congress is in the works. That's over here on this side. She's planning this meeting. Now, over here, we've got another woman named Rita Mae Brown. And she is a very socially conscious and aware young woman lesbian. She wants to be political. She wants to get something done.
Okay.
So she is... She's looking for something to join. And it listed like a dozen things that she joined. And there was a problem with this one and a problem with that one and a problem with this one. And I'm like, But anyway, so in the late 60s, she joins the New York chapter of NAV because they cared about women's rights. She joined one group that was for gay people, but then she didn't realize that gay men were men.
Oh, yeah, that's troubling.
It is. You know, lesbians are women and gay men are men.
Which is weird because...
It is.
If gay men weren't men, they wouldn't be gay men.
Right. But apparently, whether or not a man is gay, he is still misogynistic against women in the 60s.
Makes sense.
Yes. Well, yeah, it was the 60s. It's what they were. But anyway, so she joins the New York chapter of NAV. And because she felt that they were concerned about women's rights. But she's a little bit suspicious of the fact that there's not a lot of lesbians. So the homophobia of more of the conservative feminists was a hinder and a nuisance to lesbians who wanted to join NAV because they want to further women's agenda. It doesn't matter who you're sleeping with. If you're a woman and you feel and you're told that your place belongs in the kitchen, and you don't want that. You want to fight against that.
Right. You're like, no.
Doesn't matter who's in your bed. You want to be at work, not in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So they're a little concerned with the way that NAV is treating them. So at a 1969 NAV meeting for Dan, who is still concerned that the lesbians are going to ruin her group, called lesbians in her group the Lavender Menace.
The Lavender Menace.
Yes. Well, apparently lavender was a term that was used to describe homosexuals at the time, men and women both. There was another thing that I researched a little bit where during the Red Scare, there was also the Lavender, I think it was called the Lavender Scare, and government agencies were firing anyone that they suspected of being gay.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Can you even imagine?
So I thought about doing that, but this one was more fun. So she calls them the Lavender Menace, and she was concerned that they would take over, and she was concerned about how many radical lesbians were in the group, and they were just taking over, and she didn't like it. She kind of meant her words to be sort of offhand and flippant, just kind of these Lavender Menace. But of course, people grabbed onto it, and no, we're going to take this.
If that were today, that would be an instant hashtag, and there would be shirts for sale.
Keep that in mind. But yeah, it would be, she'd be canceled for sure. Out. So Brown still wants to be involved. She's like, okay, she's a bitch. Whatever. I'm just going to kind of put this in the back of my mind and keep going. So she's still looking for her organization. So she joined a radical feminist group called Red Stockings, and this was founded in January of 1969, which is the same year as the Stonewall Inn riots.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's called Red Stockings, and unlike NAV, they were more concerned with the politics of feminine respectability. They were less concerned with the politics of feminine respectability. And she was very impressed... Brown was very impressed by Red Stockings' tactics of consciousness raising. They just wanted people, just listen to our agenda. Listen to what we have to say. You can make your own decisions. You can form your own opinions after, but listen to what we have to say. What we have to say is valuable and we want you to hear it.
Hmm. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
It does. So she was really taken by this consciousness raising tactic. So now back to Fernan and her Now group. So another woman, Susan Brown Miller, was part of Now, and she's trying to downplay the damage that Fernan caused with the Lavender Menace comment. So she has a interview with the New York Times, and she says, it's not a Lavender Menace. It's more like a Lavender Herring. It's not that big of a deal. There's not that many of them. They're not trying to cause problems. It's really, it's just, it's a Lavender Herring. It's no consequence at all.
If I was part of the original Lavender Menace group and then I heard that, that would fire me up even more.
It did. The exact quote. Lavender Herring, perhaps, but surely no clear and present danger.
Oh, well, you just wait.
And yes, that is the comment that fired them up. They dismissed the Lavender Menace as whatever. She's a lesbian hater, but the...
I would have been like, she hates us, but that's pretty... We could be a menace.
We could be a menace, whatever. But being dismissed as of no consequence...
Yeah.
Really pissed them off. So they're mad now. And a... Michaela... Griffo, a 20-year-old art student activist, was absolutely infuriated by Brown Miller's patronizing words. She says, I was incensed. It was so dismissive. Susan and you followed the line with no clear and present danger. I'd always liked you before, but now you are my enemy.
Oh.
She's pissed. So, in response, she makes a t-shirt with iron-on letters that says, I am a Lavender Herring. And she wears it downtown to a dance thrown by the Gay Liberation Front, which is a coalition of gay rights groups. And everybody thought it was the most hysterical thing. They're like,
for sure.
Yeah, that's it. That's in. We like it. So, now all of these things are kind of coming together. We've got the Lavender Herring and the Lavender Menace and the social conscious raising. So people want to do something. Brown Miller kind of saw her comments as like, it's just a humorous little jab at Fernan. And she just wants to, you know, whatever. But there's a bunch of other women, Lois Hart, Cynthia Funk, Ellen Beddoes, Artemis March, and Barbara XX, who didn't like it. They're all part of Now. And they wrote down their thoughts and they put their thoughts together, and then they joined with Brown and the social consciousness thing, and they decided that they would write this out. So they wrote this out as a manifesto, and they called it Women Identified Women, or The Woman Identified Woman, and they listed the author as the Radical Lesbians, because they all came up with it together.
Oh.
So they...
They should have called it the Lavender Manifesto. The Lavender Woman-a-festo.
The Lavender Woman-a-festo. Hindsight's 2020. We should have been there to tell them what to do. But so they wanted to raise people's consciousness. So they have this manifesto. How are we going to get it out to people? We've got to somehow get people to see this.
So they got to do a stunt.
They got to do a stunt. They do a stunt. So now they've got to get this message out, and they wanted a bold way to get their point across. So Brown had heard about Zaps.
I don't know about Zaps.
Well, apparently it was a thing in the 70s. So a Zap was popularized by the post-Stonewall organization, the Gay Activist Alliance, GAA. And there was some mayor of New York or mayor of some city, and he was going to a play. And so they knew this. So they all showed up at the entrance of the play, and they all yelled homophobic slurs at him as he walked into the play.
So that was the Zap?
That was the Zap.
Okay.
So it's a stunt, basically. Yeah. It's something to get yourselves noticed. So they are planning a Zap. So in May of 1970, Brown and others called themselves the Radical Lesbians. They dyed 24 t-shirts lavender.
Ooh.
One of them was fuchsia, however, because it just came out. It was like the end of the batch or the first one of the batch or whatever. And they silk screened the word Lavender Menace across the front.
So cool. We should get one of those shirts.
Well, what is so funny is I saw a picture of one of them, and I just, the 70s were just not good for clothing. So this poor woman, and I think I remember doing this as a child. The clothing just bothered me. If my socks were not on right, it bothered me. If my collar was crooked, it bothered me. And so this poor woman was in this picture with her Lavender Menace t-shirt over the top of a long sleeve collared shirt. And her collar was all bunched up around her ears.
Oh.
And her shirt was all puffy outside of the sleeves of the t-shirt. And I just wanted to fix her.
Yeah, that would bother me.
It would just, I just wanted to help her out by pulling her shirt down or something. But anyway, so they make all these t-shirts. And they, Silk Cream, Lavender Menace across them. They print copies of their manifesto. And they make signs that say things like, you're going to love the Lavender Menace. Women's liberation is a lesbian plot. And one that I only found printed in one site. I looked at a whole bunch of sites and articles on this, but this one was only printed in one. Because I think it's something that would offend people. Super Dyke loves you.
That's funny.
I found it hysterical. But they only printed it one place. But anyway, so they had these signs that said all these things. And they decided that they're going to target the second Congress to unite women. Because the first one was such a success that Ferdinand's going to do a second one. So it's to be held in New York on May 1st, 1970 in a middle school. So they noticed, they made their thing, their manifesto copies and everything. And they go and they scout the school. So they learn where all the light switches are.
Oh, they're so smart.
So they know where all the light switches are and everything. And then they show up. It's to be kicked off at 7 p.m. in the auditorium of Intermediate School 70 on West 17th Street. So the first speaker is just about to take the stage. And then two of these women in their Lavender Menace t-shirts walk in, cut the lights and the microphone. While the lights are out, all of the rest of the women run up the aisles with their signs. So they're all lining the aisles with their signs and their t-shirts. And they flip the lights back on. And they're there with their t-shirts and their signs. And they're like, blah, blah, blah.
They probably had to draw straws, though, for who had to be the ones to turn the lights back on. Because everybody probably wanted to be on the stage.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, the poor woman who got the pink t-shirt is the one who had to sell the manifesto in the back of the auditorium. So she had to stand there and sell the copies of this. But so there was one description of the woman saying the one that was on the stage could hear all of her friends running down the aisles, just giggling and laughing. So they get there and they turn the lights back on and they start yelling and they're like, join us, join us. And they planted some people in the audience.
Oh, how smart is that?
Right. Carla J has on a red long sleeve blouse. And when they're like, join us, she stands up and she said, yes, yes, sisters, I'm tired of being in the closet because of the women's movement. And she rips off her red shirt and there's her Lavender Menace t-shirt. So then they're like, who wants to join us? And more people are like, blah, blah, blah. And then Brown, who was the instigator of the whole thing, yells up again. She's on the stage. Who wants to join us? And she takes off her t-shirt, which, you know, in the 70s, that's a huge thing. No, what are you doing? You're stripping. And underneath her t-shirt was another t-shirt. People are just dying by this point. And obviously the main reason of doing this is to
get... She should have threw her t-shirt out into the crowd.
Threw it to the audience. Woo, there you go. But they wanted to get the manifesto out, the woman-identified woman. And they succeeded. The pamphlets completely sold out. The operation was such a huge success. Afterwards, I don't know why they ended up there. I don't know why they just didn't stay at the school. But they ended up at the Church of the Holy Apostles. And they had an all-night dance party. Where just straight women, gay women, all women just danced and played all night long.
I feel like they could make a good movie about this.
Oh, it would be so cool.
Yeah.
Yes. It would really, really be neat. So at the next National Now conference, which was held in 1971. Oh, at the 1970 conference, the one that they went through, there was not one lesbian on the platform. Not one on the program. Not one lesbian issue on the program. Friedan had completely shut them out.
So I'm guessing in 71, there was some bleed through. Like
in 71,
made some progress.
Yes, they did. So that one incident change the organization and realize, hey, lesbian women, they're women.
They're women too.
They're women too. And so they had a legitimate concern for feminism. And that was adopted.
That's actually a cool, really cool story.
It's a very cool story. And I would like to see a movie of a woman ripping off her shirt saying, I want in!
And then, and then having then another shirt dance party me. Afterward.
So that's the Lavender Minute.
Well, I mean, I've never been an expert on women's issues and women's rights.
Me either. I have no interest in joining now because I like to make biscuits in the kitchen.
But I mean, I'm glad there are some people that are experts.
I am. And I will make my biscuits in the kitchen with a drink because
I'm just drunk. As always, you can contact us on Facebook at Crime and Time OTR.
On Instagram, we are Crime and Time OTR.
On Twitter, we're at Crime and Time OTR.
And our email is crimeandtimeotr@gmail.com. Email is where you will want to send us cocktail suggestions, things topics you want to learn about. Yeah.
Or just say hi.
Or just say hi.
And we also have a new Patreon page. Yay. If you want to buy us a drink.
Buy us a drink.
So that is
patreon.com/crimeandtimeotr.
And we're going to be offering some perks for our patrons.
Absolutely. I'm excited. See you there.
Thank you for listening.